From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. WGCU recently reported on the increase of transgender youth coming out nationwide. Today, we'll learn about past and present LGBT bills in the Florida legislature as the transgender community becomes more acknowledged. We'll talk with Equality Florida, a nonprofit advocacy organization, about last year's bathroom bill that died. It was an attempt to restrict restrooms as single-sex facilities, and we'll talk about a measure this year aiming to ban discrimination in the workplace. Also, 2015 was the deadliest year for the transgender community, with the highest recorded number of homicides in the country. We'll speak with an expert from the Human Rights Campaign, a national LGBT civil rights organization, about why this is happening and discuss projections for 2016. That's ahead. First, this news. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Jessica Mazaros. Coming up in a half hour, last year had the deadliest recorded numbers of transgender homicides in the country, the highest recorded numbers. 21 transgender people were murdered in 2015, according to the Human Rights Campaign, a national civil rights organization. We'll speak with an expert from the campaign about why last year was so deadly for the transgender community, and we'll discuss some projections for this year. But first, I'm joined by Gina Duncan from the nonprofit Equality Florida and Sam Leams, a transgender student at Florida Gulf Coast University. Thanks to you both for joining us on Gulf Coast Live today.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
And you can join our conversation by calling 1-877-428-8255. That's 1-877-GCU-TALK. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. Comment on Facebook at WGCU Public Media or live tweet using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. We'll talk about past and present Florida legislation regarding LGBT issues. Before we start that discussion, though, WGCU reported on the increase of transgender youth coming out in Southwest Florida and in the country. Experts say it's thanks in part to the internet. Let's take a listen to the story that first aired Monday.
It really started like as a dream. When I was in fifth grade, I had a dream that I was in like a male's body and it felt so natural.
Gabriel Martin is a 14-year-old freshman at Cypress Lake High School in Fort Myers. Gabriel is genetically female, but he came out to his family as transgender about 4 months ago.
I was expecting my sister to be okay with that because she has LGBT friends. And my brother, I knew he was going to be fine with it. It was mainly my dad I was worried about. I don't know why.
Initially, our reaction was shock.
That's Ronald Martin, Gabriel's dad.
We're still adjusting to the loss of a daughter, the hopes, the dreams that come with having a daughter. We lost a daughter, but we gained a son.
Ronald says he was amazed at how well-informed Gabriel was when he first came out.
What I'm learning is these kids, these teenagers, they're almost advanced because, you know, Gabriel had anticipated all my questions, you know, knew about hormones, knew about fertility concerns. I was impressed with the amount of research.
Southwest Florida therapist Kathy Lowry is not surprised by the increasing amount of information transgender youth are consuming. She's been working with the local trans community for about 12 years, and this surge is something she's observed within the last 2 years. She thinks it's because of social media.
They're connecting, they're finding other people in the same boat, they're not feeling so alone that maybe they felt their whole life, and they're also able to get a lot of questions answered by these people.
Lowry is also seeing more kids and teens come out as transgender now. Between 1 and 5 children attend her support group every month.
You have a kid here and you have a kid there. But there's enough, though, to where we have support groups now for trans children. So it's not like there's tons, but it is really fascinating to see.
Coming out transgender as a child was simply not an option for Jenny Beeman, who did not grow up in the internet age. Beeman is gender non-binary, meaning does not conform to a female or male identity, and goes by they-them pronouns. They say this increase in young people coming out is a movement all around the country.
It used to be an anomaly when a trans youth came out and was supported by their parents and was able to be themselves in their elementary school or middle school. Now that is no longer kind of like the exception.
For about 10 years, Beeman has trained hundreds of colleges around the country on transgender inclusion out of the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Beeman says there are no statistics right now showing this increase because society is just now starting to recognize diverse gender identities. Applications and forms historically only ask whether you're male or female. Beeman did not come out until about 30 years old because of available information, or lack thereof.
The internet was really a dividing line for people in terms of prior to the wide availability of the internet. People, myself included, really didn't understand ourselves, oftentimes felt that we were the only one like ourselves, that we were some sort of a freak.
Beeman says before the internet, libraries were the main resources of information, which were not really helpful to transgender people.
Going through the old card catalog system was going to be pretty negative material. And so we were really isolated and, for many of us, denied who we were. It's very different for younger people today who can go online.
14-year-old Gabriel Martin does not think he would have come out so soon had he grown up in Beeman's time.
I would feel really scared to come out if I was born back, like, in third generation. Like, I would probably hold it off until I was 20 or 30.
But Gabriel's family fully supports him, using the right pronouns and calling him by his new name.
When they first started calling me Gabriel, it felt a little strange because I never was called a guy name by my family. So it was really strange at first, but then, like, it's normal. Like, they treat me like their son or their brother.
Gabriel says when he grows up, he might become a therapist for transgender people. He wants to support the trans community and help it become more acknowledged. I'm Jessica Mazaros, and this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm joined by Gina Duncan with Equality Florida and Sam Leams, an FGCU trans student. Gina Duncan, I'd like to start by talking about the bathroom bill that died in the state legislature last year. It was sponsored by Republican Representative Frank Artiles of Miami. He wanted public restrooms in all Florida counties except Miami-Dade to be single-sex-only facilities. But even though the bill died last year, Florida has at least 10 counties that adopted similar language through local ordinances. Why are public bathrooms such a hot-button issue for the transgender community?
Well, I think it's a vulnerable area simply because it appeals to people's emotions without understanding the full gravity of the situation. I think it's important to understand that all of us, including transgender people, certainly care about safety in public places and certainly care about safety and privacy in bathrooms. Where we've seen the pivot since marriage equality has come about in our nation, that the crosshairs of discrimination have been aimed at the transgender community, and they have used the bathroom myth to position themselves to oppose public policy, local ordinances, and things like that.
What is the bathroom myth?
The bathroom myth is that by passing fully inclusive human rights ordinances that allow people to not be discriminated against in the areas of employment, housing, and bathrooms, such as in the topic of public accommodations, to where people should be able to use the restroom that aligns with their gender identity. They are equating this to opening the door to public facilities, to sexual predators, and for pedophiles to commit crimes under the guise of these human rights ordinances. It's important to note that there have been numerous national studies and a recent state study done by the Media Matters think tank, which showed that there has been absolutely no increases in public safety in passing these human rights ordinances.
What exactly are the restrictions in these county ordinances issued around the state?
Well, the restrictions, currently, the restrictions are that people can be discriminated against in public places. Both state and national laws do not include gender identity and sexual orientation in protections in being discriminated against in public accommodations, restaurants, bathrooms, etc. And that's what these laws and human rights ordinances across Florida, which currently roughly 41 have been passed in the last two decades, to protect people in public accommodations.
Are there any indications of how it's working in these 41 places, how the communities are handling these ordinances?
Yes, indeed. The recent study that Media Matters did, they went back and they
What is Media Matters?
Media Matters is a think tank, is a national publication that studies advancements in LGBT issues.
Okay.
And they went back and they studied and they talked to and they polled municipalities that have previously passed human rights ordinances across the state. They talked to not only elected officials, but they also spoke to law enforcement. And perhaps most importantly, they spoke to law enforcement. And what they found, without deviation, that in all of these places, there has not been any increases whatsoever in public safety issues where human rights ordinances have been passed, in reference to bathrooms especially. So the bathroom predator myth that continues to be propagated by opponents of equal rights legislation, they're being galvanized by what occurred in Houston, which used this argument against the human rights ordinance, and they're hoping that this will be a linchpin for defeating equal rights legislation across the state.
And let's talk about Miami-Dade. It's the only county in the state to pass an anti-discrimination kind of an ordinance that essentially allows anyone to use public restrooms regardless of their birth gender. Gina Duncan, what's going on in Miami?
Well, laws are in place and have always been in place that restrooms are segregated facilities, in that in people wanting safety and privacy in bathrooms, these laws do not allow men to use restrooms, that they are to men to use female restrooms and females to use men restrooms.
Right.
They are segregated facilities, and this law does not change that. Anyone committing crimes in a restroom now will be arrested, as they will be arrested after a human rights ordinance has been passed.
You're saying even in Miami with this the ordinance that was passed recently?
Absolutely. Miami has roughly 12 laws that cover public accommodations and safety for citizens in public places, and that protects people from any kind of violence or criminal mischief in public places, including bathrooms.
So let's take a listen to Representative Frank Artiles, the bathroom bill sponsor from last year. He was recorded by the Florida Channel speaking at a House subcommittee meeting about the measure. Democratic Representative Lori Berman of Boynton Beach is first to speak. She's questioning him about this bill.
Representative Artiles, since the passing of the Miami-Dade Human Rights Ordinance, has there been any provable increase in criminal activity to demonstrate the need for this bill?
Representative Artiles.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. This is a proactive measure, not a reactionary measure. But to answer your question, sexual crimes in Miami-Dade County has had a 16% increase in the last 2 years.
Representative Berman.
And when was the ordinance passed?
Representative December 2nd, Madam Chair.
You're recognized.
December 2nd.
So Representative Artiles is essentially saying with his bill that died that so there are 10 Florida counties at least that have adopted these ordinances against for bathrooms. And he's trying to pass a state law making all the state counties cohesive or was last year. Sam Leams of FGCU, when you have to use a public restroom, what's the first thought that comes to your mind?
It's safety. So it's a lot of mental calculations that you wouldn't normally make. So I have to kind of I look at myself at the day, you know, how many people were seeing me as male today? How many people were recognizing me as like female, and kind of do like a quick mental calculation of, you know, how masculine or feminine I'm looking that day in order to decide which bathroom is going to be safer.
And so how long is that process, that mental process usually?
It's pretty quick now. But before it was definitely something that I waited till the last possible second, really, because I was so afraid. I was so nervous.
And so how would a state bill or a county ordinance like this change your everyday life?
You know, for me, like these bills, what people don't realize is that people who are already kind of – transgender people already use the restrooms because there's – you know, you can't tell a lot of times that someone's going to be – that someone's transgender. Like, they just go about their daily life. So what this bill really targets are people like me who are, like, in middle of transition, or people who don't care to fit into, like, a binary, you know, look of gender, people who are visibly gender different. Those are the people that get targeted by these things. And so I'm not someone who even though I'm in this middle of the stage for transition, my goal is never to actually be this perfectly binarily identified person, someone that you could look at and 100% go, yes, absolutely male. So it increases the risk for me because now, you know, neither bathroom – which bathroom do I go to? There's no real safety. You know, women are going to be panicked if I go into the women's bathroom, and men are going to, you know – question it if I walk into their bathroom, you know. So it's going to be a challenge all around.
And so what's it like for you to go to the bathroom, something that people do every day, going to a public bathroom? Do you just go in and not look at anybody, or do you – like what's usually your protocol when you go in?
I was – at first when I was first like transitioning, like coming out, that was definitely my protocol, like just walk in, look at the floor, like go to the, you know, the first stall. And now I'll admit I have a much more kind of blasé attitude towards it. I just go in and, you know, kind of am confident, like, this is where I, you know, it's okay that I'm in here. I'm here just doing, you know, what I need to do. I am not causing any trouble, you know, so it shouldn't be an issue. So I kind of walk in with a lot more confidence than I used to.
How long did it take you to build that confidence?
Like over a year, I think, like a year and a half, something like that.
Just want to remind our listeners, you can join our conversation about bills in the Florida legislature regarding LGBT issues by calling 1-877-428-8255. That's 1-877-GCU-TALK. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. Comment on Facebook at WGCU Public Media, or live tweet using the hashtag GulfCoastLive. So the bathroom bill died last year in the Florida legislature, and this year we have a bill by Democratic Representative Janet Cruz of Tampa that aims to ban discrimination in the workplace. Gina Duncan, what can you tell us about this bill?
Well, the bill, the Florida Competitive Workforce Act, is designed to finally connect this patchwork of human rights ordinances that we have across the state. The bill is designed to protect people, especially now that marriage equality has come to our state, in the area of employment. You know, most major employers already have fully inclusive diversity platforms. Employers know that having an open and welcoming environment in the workplace provides them with a competitive work advantage. They're able to recruit and hire the best and the brightest. And frankly, millennials are looking for those kind of companies. The Human Rights Campaign published their Corporate Equality Index, and companies are looking at that, and they're looking at their grade, and they're looking where they rank, and they want to be known and their reputation to be an open and welcoming and inclusive place for all workers. And the millennials are wanting to work for companies like that. Companies find that having fully inclusive workplaces provide them with a competitive work advantage as far as recruiting.
Sam Leams, you're nodding your head. What do you think of this legislation?
I mean, it's fantastic. And we definitely – you're right about millennials. Like, we share this information. You know, if companies have, you know, policies that aren't inclusive, you know, we make it known. And, you know, you'll find if you're, like, on Tumblr or something, whole lists of transgender inclusive workplaces and ones that aren't. So it's definitely a well kind of known thing in the community. We talk about these things. You know, every measure of equality, I mean, that's a good thing. Every protection, because, you know, employment, that's like it's a fundamental right. Like, you need to be able to work in order to survive in our society. So,
Sam, have you ever encountered discrimination in the workplace yourself?
No, I'm really lucky. The place that I work at, I've worked at for them for like 2 years, and I came out at work, and they've been fabulous the whole time. I'm really accepting.
You don't have to name the company, but what do you do?
I work retail, so pretty run in the mill. But
so do you know of people in the transgender community that have maybe been discriminated against in the workplace? Have you heard these stories before?
Yeah, and definitely in our local community. Usually they're kind of smaller places, but some bigger names too that I can't like discuss the details, but that there's litigation against them, and you know it's a long process. So it's definitely out there.
What kinds of things were done to the transgender people that you know that were considered discrimination?
Things like inviting people in for like the interviews and being really excited, and then looking when their paperwork came in and there was like a, you know, a difference between their gender on paper and the gender they presented, you know, suddenly being uninterested in them, and that being a very obvious thing, or being basically blatantly told, you know, like you can't work in this environment, being as visible, you know, as you are, like as visible as a transgender person, being denied supervisory positions on that basis because you'd be, you know, working with the public too much. So definitely heard different things across the board.
So this may be a simple question, but how would this bill have affected that situation or those situations that you've described, this anti-discrimination bill?
I think, one, it's going to make companies think twice before doing this, reevaluate their policies, make sure that they're, you know, abiding by the laws. And then I think it'll make it easier for people when they do encounter this to actually have, you know, some sort of ability to come back and say, hey, you know, this isn't allowable, you know, have some measure of recourse.
Right. Gina Duncan, are there any other state legislative measures we should be keeping an eye on this year regarding LGBT issues?
Well, the main one, of course, is the Florida Competitive Workforce Act, which is for the first time going to be heard on Monday in committee. And Equality Florida is working very hard on the ground to gather bipartisan support. And we're hoping for the best in reference to the Competitive Workforce Act.
And this goes for the both of you. What future legislative protections would you like to see in Florida for trans people? Maybe, Gina, you can go first.
Well, there's a lot of work to be done in so many different areas. If we cannot get the Competitive Workforce Act through, then we continue to work on the ground in reference to putting together human rights ordinances across the state. Currently, Equality Florida is working to pass human rights ordinances in Palm Bay, Jacksonville, and Pensacola. So in lieu of having a statewide law, we're working towards local ordinances to be able to protect people in these areas.
And what are you hearing from people in these areas, Gina?
Well, quite frankly, we're hearing that it's needed. You know, it's a very divisive, unfortunately, a very divisive issue. And people are just as passionate against passing human rights ordinances as there is a need for people to have the law updated to ensure that everyone, you know, in our state, including people who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender, that everyone has the opportunity to be judged on their job performance and qualifications and nothing more and nothing less.
And what about you, Sam? What would you like to see for become Florida law in the future?
So sort of to add, you know, beyond the jobs and housing and things, the education aspect of it. So like California, you know, passed in their, you know, that their schools could not discriminate against transgender students, that they had to have, you know, equal access to the facilities, to after school sports that were like gender segregated, things like that. And I definitely think we need our own measure like that for the schools. Anti-bullying laws. I know there was, you know, fights about that in Collier County that shouldn't be, you know, there was defenses made that shouldn't be something that we put in anti, you know, bullying, like, I guess, oh, goodness, not legislation, because you don't really legislate that, mm-hmm. but in the, you know, each county by county. Mm-hmm. So all those things.
Yes, Gina?
Well, I was going to say that the Department of Education has issued several rulings in reference to policies and guidelines in schools.
Right.
And several national organizations have published guidelines for school boards to follow in reference to LGBT protections, and especially the transgender community, because it is such a rapidly emerging community. A recent collaborative guidebook, which was recently published, called Schools in Transition, is absolutely a state-of-the-art publication that addresses everything from school place protocol and policy to implementation to bathroom policy, et cetera. And we're seeing that not only is this needed in our schools, but because of the community emerging so rapidly due to social media and due to national influences like Caitlyn Jenner, that there's education needed in the areas of law enforcement, in the areas of working with our churches, in the areas of course, schools, as we talked about, and also in working with the media. Oftentimes, people are misgendered, mispronounced, et cetera, when the media is reporting on stories involving transgender people.
Right. I was going to ask, what kind of education do you think, like general education, you mentioned police and schools, what kind of information would you like to project to them, I guess?
Well, in my role with Equality Florida, I do a great deal of corporate training. And this is kind of morphed to where the training is involving those areas as well as the medical community. And the trainings evolve or progress from basic transgender 101 to understanding, you know, what it means to be transgender, the transgender journey, to developing workplace protocols that protect people in the workplace or provide guidance to, say, the medical community in assimilating a transgender person into a hospital and making that a positive experience, not only for the patient, but also for the hospital, so that there's no liability in reference to that situation. And it's as, you know, it's as, of course, important to transgender people, but it's as, you know, precise as the correct pronouns, to identification policies and things like that. If someone is presenting in a certain way, yet their IDs are different, how do you handle that? Those are the kind of educational activities that we're doing all across the state.
Great. And that's all the time that we have for this segment of Gulf Coast Live. Thank you, Gina, and thank you, Sam, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Gina Duncan is with Equality Florida, and Sam Leams is a student at FGCU. It's time for a break. When we return, a conversation with the Human Rights Campaign about last year, the deadliest year for the transgender community. This is WGCU News, NPR for Southwest Florida. Stay with us. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Jessica Mazaros. We've been talking about the increase in transgender youth coming out nationwide, and I have Jay Brown on the line with me today. He's with the Human Rights Campaign, a national civil rights organization. Thank you for joining us, Jay.
Thanks so much for having me.
You can join our conversation by calling 1-877-428-8255. That's 1-877-GCU-TALK. Send email to Gulf Coast Live at WGCU.org, comment on Facebook at WGCU Public Media, or live tweet using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. The Human Rights Campaign recently released a report documenting the murders of transgender people across the country. It found that 2015 was the deadliest recorded year for the transgender people. Before we get into that conversation, we're going to let a local transgender woman tell her story. Jenna Satterfield of Fort Myers grew up in Philadelphia, but moved to Fort Myers, where she eventually transitioned in 1995. This is Jenna's story.
To go back, I'd have to go back to when I was about 4 or 5 years old. And I remember that I was outside. I don't know why I was outside. And I was pushing my sister's doll carriage on the sidewalk. And my father came out. And I felt it was right to do that. But he came out and he grabbed me by the arm and took me in the house. He says, "You're not supposed to play with them. You play with these." And handed me a toy gun and a tank. I learned very early that I had to play the game and be what others thought I should be. Playing army, playing sports, building scale models of cars and airplanes and ships, and learning all I could about army and navy and air force and things like that. I'm a wealth of information about late 1930s to 1940s aircraft and ships and a lot of useless information. That's what playing the game was. It didn't keep me out of my mother's purse and her Coty 24 red lipstick. It was called that for a reason. It stayed there for 24 hours. So, yes, she knew it. And put it on. And just look at myself with wearing it, you know, wearing the red lipstick. My mother had found my stashes. This is something common with every other transsexual that I've ever met, or every transgender that I've ever met. Clothing, makeup, jewelry, shoes, whatever. My mom destroyed mine every time she found it. Many hundreds of dollars got destroyed. You're not supposed to be doing this. Why don't you change? And why do you have to be like that? And screaming. You know, it was not a discussion. It was screaming. And occasionally a backhand across the cheek. It took me moving over 1,000 miles away from her to finally transition. Once I did transition, change my name legally and all that, there was a time when we would talk on the phone and she would use my old name, which is dead. I don't use it. And I wouldn't answer. And then one time she said, you know, when you changed your name, it broke my heart. I said, I had to do it. She eventually started understanding. The former name, for me, it's a sore point. It hurts. Pronouns are far more important. Pronouns, the wrong pronoun could get you killed. There's a big enough target on my back now. I have been called every name in the book by people in Fort Myers. I've had things thrown at me. I've had people go around the block just to come back and yell a name at me. I've had gasoline thrown at me. And I've been shot at in Fort Myers. I've built a wall up around me. You get to the point where it's not that you don't care. It's just that you expect it, and you're on guard for it. We are now kicking open that closet door and looking for not only recognition, but verification of our status. We are a community that, though we are semi-visible, we are everywhere. We're your doctor, lawyer, mechanic, cop, pilot, soldier. We're your son or daughter. We're not evil. We're not out to take over the world or anything like that. We just want to live.
You're listening to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Jessica Mazaros with Jay Brown of the Human Rights Campaign on the line. Jay, is Jenna's story a common one you hear? People shooting at transgender people on the street and throwing things like gasoline at them?
I think, unfortunately, the answer is that Jenna's story is not uncommon. I think, especially for trans women who face often a great amount of stigma and harassment in their daily lives, Jenna's story will probably ring very true. You know, I think, you know, early on you talked about last year being the most deadly one on record. Last year we saw at least 21 trans people, almost all of them trans women of color, die from homicide, and many of them shared very similar experiences.
How did the Human Rights Campaign conduct this study last year?
We've been tracking the deaths of trans people for several years now, and have been reporting on it as well. But we really pulled together all the data that we could find from the last year, put together a pretty comprehensive report along in partnership actually with the Trans People of Color Coalition, a great organization, to really shine a spotlight on this in a significant way. The data that we also pulled together looked at the FBI Uniform Crime Reports, which just recently started including gender identity in the data that they collect as far back as 2013. So it's really something that I think advocates, many of us, have been aware of for a long time, and the data has just been very hard to come by. I think one thing that's very interesting is as the public's understanding of trans people and the media's understanding of trans people improves, we are learning more about these murders. I don't think there's any clear evidence that 2015 was perhaps any worse than any other year. It could have been the same as many years in the past, but for now, we are finally hearing about these stories in a way that is much more clear that the victims were trans.
Right.
Lots of times they're misgendered.
Right. That's why we see the report. This is a recorded homicides for 2015.
And so
you mentioned that the you were correlating with the FBI in 2013. You were kind of going along with their information. So is that how long the Human Rights Campaign has been tracking these homicides since 2013?
Yeah. And there's been a lot of tracking of these deaths sort of on an individual basis, but we've been doing it nationally since then.
And what did the most recent study find? So there was 21 murders last year, and what else did the study find?
At least 21 of them. There were almost all of them were transgender women of color. I think there were two women who were white, and all of them were either transgender women or experiencing being transgender on a spectrum and on. They were assigned male at birth, but were, feminine in their presentation. Mm-hmm. The age range is vast, but a lot of young women, unfortunately, have been killed. In Florida, just in one year, two trans women were killed. In the last since 2013, there have been four women in Florida who have been killed, mm-hmm. And that's of course only the ones we know about.
I just want to remind our listeners that you can join our conversation about violence against transgender people by calling 1-877-428-8255. That's 1-877-GCU-TALK. Send email to GulfCoastLive@WGCU.org. You can comment on Facebook at WGCU Public Media or live tweet using the hashtag GulfCoastLive. So, Jay, 21 transgender people were recorded murdered in the country last year. So we talked about some of the trends. What are some other trends to these murder cases that we're seeing?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you look at, so from 2013 to 2015, we've tracked at least 53 known trans victims. We know that 46 or 87% of them were trans people of color. We know that at least 46 of those 53 were trans women. 74% were under the age of 35. At least 8 or 15% of them were killed by intimate partners. So we know a lot about also the reality that many of these women were living in poverty. Many of these women were unable to find jobs. There's one story that came out of Norfolk, Virginia, and the media, when they interviewed the victim's sisters, her sister remembered going to job interviews with her on multiple occasions and just knowing from that first look that her sister wasn't going to get the job, despite being completely qualified for the position. And sometimes, when you're in a situation like that, then you're forced into a survival economy. And so some of the women have certainly been in survival economies and been facing stigma and violence on the streets. But some of them, too, have been from their intimate partners. And it's really, when you think about Jenna's story, just walking down the street is a daily challenge for her, and that's the reality that many people are living with. In some cases, it's also the best of times for trans people. We have significant protections, thanks to President Obama and the administration, that we didn't have just a few years ago. We have growing visibility and understanding in the media. We did a poll at the Human Rights Campaign asking people if they personally knew somebody trans. The first sort of number on that we saw was in 2008. Only 8% of people knew they were trans. In 2014, that number had risen from 8% all the way up to 17%. And in 2015, that number had risen to 22%. So there's a great deal more visibility and a great deal more understanding of trans people. There's a long way to go, though, to make sort of the daily lived experience for trans people safe and welcoming and a reality that means that they can actually thrive.
I understand you mentioned unemployment. I understand many transgender people are unemployed. Many are poor and homeless, which contributes to the circumstances leading up to some of these homicide cases. Why are there so many trans people in this situation?
I think stigma has a whole heck of a lot to do with it. I mean, that story of the young woman in Norfolk, completely qualified, hands in her resume, gets the job, gets the interview, shows up in person, and people, outright rejected her. The reality is, and Gina Duncan is doing some amazing work with Equality Florida and training corporations. We have done a lot of work in trying to make sure that corporate environments are safe and welcoming and inclusive. And in fact, a lot of the corporate major companies have led the way in advancing inclusive healthcare benefits, non-discrimination policies and such. But, you know, just the understanding of trans people, in somebody's daily life, still when somebody doesn't know somebody, often they think of us sort of as an other. And the reality is they're getting to know us, and there's a lot of stigma we have to reduce in the meantime.
So these businesses and the corporations that you're talking about, what's the conversation like with them compared to, let's say, a corporation that does not accept trans people? What are they doing different than other corporations?
Well, I think, for a lot of the companies that we work with, they recognize that that diversity in their workforce is a strength. It adds to their work product, that employees who feel that they can bring their full selves to work and who are protected by policies and benefits that allow them to do that, they're stronger workers. And that's something that I think a lot of corporate leaders understand. I think, when you get to a place where that's not the morale, and that's not the driving business force, you see both a bad environment for the individual, but also a bad environment for the work product.
Let's talk about a specific case, a homicide case. Christina Gomez Rainwald, also known as Christina Grant Infinity, was a 46-year-old transgender woman from Miami who was fatally stabbed last year. What, Jay, can you tell us about Christina's case?
Yeah, so initially the police ruled Christina's death a suicide, but they later reopened her investigation and ruled her death a homicide. Nobody was arrested at last reports, but her friends contend that she was killed by her ex-boyfriend. She was well-known in the community, and, of course, in Florida, the hate crimes law doesn't protect individuals on the basis of gender identity. There's a similar – the other death in Florida that's worth raising up is India Clark, who was – a black trans woman from Tampa. She was 25 years old, and she was fatally beaten and shot July 21st. Her alleged assailant, Keith Galliard, reportedly killed a man a week later, and he was arrested for both murders. I think there are some cases where like, for example, in Christina's case, the details of the crime are very hard to parse out. In India's case, you can see that the perpetrator actually had a streak of violence against gay and trans people, and this is why sort of parsing something out as a bias motivated crime is very tricky. It's probably the fact that in many of these cases bias played a huge role, but without a hate crimes law and without law enforcement sort of working with that in mind, it can be very hard to tell what actually happened.
And why do you think Florida doesn't have a hate crimes law that pertains to transgender people, the transgender community?
Yeah, I mean, I think that would probably be a great question for Equality Florida. I know they're working on to resolve that. I think in the earlier days of our movement, clearly trans people were not part of many organizations' mission statements, including HRCs, and we moved together to change that in major ways. And I think as a movement now, sexual orientation, gender identity, when we're looking at legislation, we really push to make sure that our legislators know that they both must be included. In fact, HRC doesn't support any bills, state or federal, that don't include gender identity today. But the reality of our history as a movement is different.
And what usually happens to the murder cases of transgender people like Christina in India from Florida? I mean, so there were arrests in their cases. Is that always the case for these kinds of crimes?
You know, that's a great question. I think there are certainly cases of law enforcement not handling these cases responsibly. We have certainly worked with the FBI to make sure that they are aware of every case that we are made aware of, so that they can then reach out to local law enforcement, make sure that they know that they're available as a resource and that they're actually, you know, watching what's happening. But we do know from our research that there are quite a few law enforcement agencies who have followed up, who have prosecuted, or where the perpetrators are being sentenced. It's a lot of these cases, since they're so within the last year, they're still in trial or in motion. But there is some degree, I think, of law enforcement engagement on this. Not to say there couldn't certainly and shouldn't be more. I think it was Gina who was earlier talking about the need for more training among law enforcement, which is a huge need and something that the FBI actually is doing work to try to resolve, along with a lot of community advocates who go out and train local law enforcement. We have a tool called the Municipal Equality Index that ranks cities and large municipalities on how their laws protect LGBT mm-hmm. people. And one of the things that we score some cities on is whether or not they have an LGBT liaison on their police force who can make a really huge difference in how the law enforcement understand and work with the trans community.
So does the HRC, is it involved in any direct training with law enforcement agencies or communities around the country?
We've done some as volunteers as well. Some of our volunteers have worked with the FBI locally. Fortunately, there are a lot of organizations who are doing this. The National Coalition of Anti-Violence Programs is a really great organization that does a significant amount of training with law enforcement, as well as the Matthew Shepard Foundation, which does a lot, and we work in partnership with them.
And do you find that law enforcement officers are generally receptive to the education? What's the conversation like?
You know, I think it really depends on the situation, but I think there are certainly some really, you know, amazing police forces that are working to try to do better by the community at large. And then, you know, there are even trans people on the force who are making a huge difference. In Austin, we honored this weekend an openly trans member of the police force. In D.C., we have Sergeant Jessica Hawkins, who is our LGBT liaison and is trans as well, and she has made a really critical difference in working with the trans community. I think there's certainly more that needs to be done, involving the trans community with police forces at a local level and can be done by local advocates.
And we were talking about hate crimes laws earlier. Are there other transgender protections and hate crimes laws in other states that HRC would point as a model for what Florida should adopt?
Yeah, I mean, there are many states that have hate crimes laws that include both sexual orientation and gender identity. That should be what is on the books in all states. We actually just today released our state equality index. If you go to hrc.org, you'll find that index, and you'll see where the state of Florida stands on a range of issues, but if you have listeners from other states and they're interested in the national picture, that's a great resource to look at what the state laws are.
Great. And anything happening on the federal level that we should know about protection-wise?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think one thing that that's really key here is, you know, what we're really talking about is violence that a lot of people are facing because they're jobless, because they lack housing or consistent shelter. There are a range of protections that are needed at the federal level. While the Obama administration has made some really great policy changes through regulations, we still lack an explicit federal law that protects LGBT people, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and trans people from discrimination in housing and employment and credit and public accommodations. We've worked in a coalition with some members in Congress who have introduced the Equality Act, which is a comprehensive federal legislation that would change this reality and provide explicit protections for the first time for the LGBT community.
And I don't know if you have this answer, but how does Florida fare in the HRC report that was out recently compared to other states?
You know, I do not have that answer right at my fingertips.
Sure, no worries.
But equality, we actually work really closely with Equality Florida, and okay. And I know that they're hard at work on some legislation now. So check out the guide and reach out to Equality Florida for more details on the state.
Sure. And looking on a national scale, are there regions of the country that are clearly better or worse than others when it comes to protections for the trans community?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a challenging thing. So you'd think that a state like Massachusetts would be amazing, but the Massachusetts folks are still working on trying to add gender identity to a key piece of law up there. I think it can be a patchwork in many places. There are some really great things. The earlier person who talked about California's law is spot on. They have a really great safe schools bill. But there are a lot of different models to look at, and a lot of states that are doing right in many ways. But there's certainly more that needs to be done at the federal and in level and in many states, including Florida.
So what does the Human Rights Campaign expect for 2016? Are you projecting the murder rates to increase, to decrease, to stay the same?
I wouldn't want to project anything sort of based on the little data that
right.
we know that's guaranteed. We know that already this past week, a homicide in Austin was reported. It was initially this victim, Monica Larea. Her death was initially not known to the trans community because they misgendered her upon the first set of news reports. But a community member surfaced that she was trans, and now many people, now we can track it, now we know about that. But that's the reality, and we won't know until we can uncover what really happened and who the victims were.
And Jay, I want to ask you, so why do you do this kind of work?
Yeah, so I'm trans. Now, I think there are a lot of folks here who do this kind of work who aren't trans, but I'm a trans guy, and I have had amazing support. I have had amazing, employers. I have had really incredible family members and friends who have supported me along the way. And the reality is, when I walk down the street, nobody knows I'm trans. I don't deal with the daily stigma of being visibly trans, and it's something I see many of my friends and colleagues deal with on a daily basis. And I'm also a dad, and I have two little girls, and I want this world to be a place where whoever they grow up to be is going to be a safe and welcoming place to them. And the reality is that we, as a community, have a long way to go to treating not just trans people better, but treating women better. And I feel very dedicated to making their future a little brighter and helping create a safer world for all my trans sisters and brothers.
And was it always the case that you were not visibly trans? Was that always the
case?
Yeah,
that's a great question. I think for me, the days that I felt the most threat of violence or stigma from my identity was when I was transitioning, people didn't know what to make of me, and it was scary. I didn't want to use the bathroom publicly. I was worried about saying something in a public space that might sort of out me, and having to deal with a reaction that could be hostile or violent. That's the reality for many people, and it's something we've got to fix.
And does the Human Rights Campaign have any plans to combat the violence against the transgender community this year?
Yeah, we're going to continue to work on really raising public awareness about this issue in a big way. In November, when we released this report with the Trans People of Color Coalition, we also worked with members of Congress to hold the first ever hearing on the issue of trans violence. And we worked to bring a bunch of advocates from all over the U.S. and folks together to testify in Congress about the realities that conspire to create a situation where 21 people were killed last year. There are more ways we can be doing that, raising public's awareness, raising the attention level, getting our elected officials involved at a federal and at a state and local level, and we're committed to doing that.
Great. That's all the time we have. Thank you so much for joining us, Jay.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for addressing this really critical issue.
Jay Brown is with the Human Rights Campaign. You can continue the conversation online on Facebook at WGCU Public Media or on Twitter using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. Information online at WGCU.org/Gulf Coast Live. This is WGCU FM, Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida. I'm Jessica Mazaros. Thank you to my producers John Davis and Richard Cinque. Have a great afternoon.